very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. I'm talking to Scott Turow today, the author, most recently, of The Burden of Proof, a new book from Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, also the author of Presumed Innocent and a nonfiction book, 1L, about a year in Harvard Law School. Those of us who have been following his story know that he is a practicing lawyer and that he came to the law after a protracted stint in different writing programs. I thought we'd leave the autobiographical things to the side and talk mostly about how a book like The Burden of Proof gets written and other matters, questions of innocence and guilt, will be free to come up. Thank you for coming here to be with us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me, this book is an immensely complex book. Even as far as clever and dexterous mysteries go, the emotional complexities of the book are enormous. How does a book like this get plotted? It clearly is not an improvisation. Do you start with loads of notes?
I'm going to make you unhappy and tell you the truth, which is that it is an improvisation. I think, for me as a writer, the one thing that has made both Presumed Innocent and The Burden of Proof successful in by my own lights is the fact that I literally have started where everybody always says they start, with characters, and certain concepts of what I wanted to happen with them. In The Burden of Proof, there is a moment where Stern realizes that he happens to have fallen in love with a particular young woman. And that was an image to me that was there almost from the start. The final chapter in the book was another image that was always there to me. And there were many others that came along the way, and I sort of danced between them. And some of the complications of the plot arise from the fact that it's how do I get from, you know, point Q back to point C and then over to point Z, and it does end up being in many ways improvised. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm not carrying it around in my head and refining. But I think to an extent that would astonish people, it's certainly not planned to start. I really do begin with the characters, images, particular scenes.
But there's a very well-shaped sense of dramaturgy in the book. There are four or five different plot lines, really, as well as a flashback structure, and all of these, it may just be the instinctive life of the courtroom, all the evidence is hauled in at the proper moment.
That does not happen by accident. My years around creative writing programs gave me a deep sense of what I consider to be classical story structure, which I believe, by the way, is the same whether it's Chekhov or a mystery. And that there's no doubt that I am always hanging things on that armature. And I am, you know, I'm very formalistic and about following that. Maybe too formalistic. Maybe I could be criticized for it. But you're certainly correct that you know, my own view is the only thing that's going to hold these books together is to follow that kind of very formal structure. And, you know, there is a kind of rhythm that you can count to in The Burden of Proof or Presumed Innocent, you know, with different themes coming back at prescribed times.
Jack Barth, too, used to say
that no matter how experimental, there were certain things that were always basically dramaturgically true of any good fiction, and that these, you know, basic elements of plotting would hold true whether you were reading, you know, Donald Barthelme or reading Scott Turow. How does... I get, you know, they often say that a writer starts with a sense of his own voice and a love of words, and that the that ability to put a book together, to plot a novel, comes more gradually. Were there previous books before Presumed Innocent?
Many. You know, it depends how you want to count. But I began writing novels when I was a freshman in college. And, you know, I made a serious stab at it then. I made a not-so-serious stab in my sophomore year when I wrote a crime novel on a bet with my roommates. In my senior year, I wrote a group of stories and a novella. And then when I was at Stanford as a fellow and later lecturer, I wrote another novel, which, you know, was the first quote-unquote mature effort. All of those books, though, met the same fate. You know, they're all in a desk drawer. I'm sure the total number of rejections that those books incurred was probably, you know, close to 100. There was also a novella, by the way, while I was writing Presumed Innocent that I sent briefly to New York until various writer friends told me it wasn't done and I withdrew it. But there is lots of failure in on my road to success, and a lot of learning by doing and not doing too well.
You know, my favorite notes on writing are not very well known, but at one point the Georgia Review published some letters from Sally Gordon to Flannery O'Connor, virtually correcting her, imagine, step by step through Wiseblood, and I found there the most astonishingly detailed but knowledgeable suggestions for, you know, how to write and how to shape. What were the things that were useful to you?
The things that were useful to me came mostly in the writing seminar at Stanford. And there was a professor there, Dick Scowcroft, who is not as well known as his other counterpart in my era there, Wallace Stegner, both of whom were gifted teachers of writing, but Wally had just about given it up, and Dick was still on the scene. And Dick just had a terrific sense of novelistic structure, and I learned a lot. He had various metaphors. There were certain kinds of... He'd talk about the strand of pearls. He'd talk about in terms of scenes. He'd talk about, you know, the strands of a rope in terms of the way things are twisted together. They always were quoting an old aphorism of Chekhov's, and I don't even know what the how it's correctly put, but the bottom line is that... you know, Chekhov said that you can't have a shooting in the third act unless there's a gun hanging on the wall in the first. And as simple-minded as that is, it became an astonishing concept to me.
Listeners of Bookworm know that we have found out that that is not Chekhov, nor, on the other hand,
is
it Neil Simon. It is Ibsen.
Is that right?
Generations of writing teachers all over the world say Chekhov. I've always said Chekhov. It was corrected. On the show, in fact, we had a small contest.
I was almost positive that it had to arise out of Uncle Vanya.
Yes, it would seem so, but it's Ibsen. After, you know, we sent squadrons of research assistants to check Chekhov's letters, and no rifles in the first act in Chekhov.
I'll be doggone.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, that's fascinating.
I was really surprised.
And I must tell you, I got this from, you know, the great authorities like, you know, Stegner, and, well, very interesting.
And, well, it gets handed on. I think it's... just one of those urban legends, mm-hmm, that we've perpetrated in American
really
writing
is.
Programs. I'm talking to Scott Turow, the author most recently of The Burden of Proof from Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. You had done some journeyman work with Tilly Olson.
Yeah.
What was she like?
Tilly's wonderful. Actually, she was the next name I was getting to in answer to the question you just asked before. I learned different things from Tilly. I did not learn ultimately about the kinds of structural matters that I was able to take away from the Stanford writing program and really make my own. I learned first and foremost about a writer's concern for language, which in some ways was different than a critic's concern for language, which I was learning from English teachers. I'll never forget her saying, I was praising Faulkner to her one day, and she looked at me and she says, you know, content does count. Tilly is an old leftist revolutionary and wasn't pleased with, you know, Faulkner's complacency with some of the hard truths of Southern life in his era. I learned about a writer's passion from her, a commitment, her dedication to to her own creative process was really striking to me. And she was really the first writer who I knew was a great writer who took me seriously. And that was probably her greatest gift of all, was to look at me and say, I take you seriously. There's something in you that I respond to as, writer and reader. And it was, that was the kindest thing of many kind things that she did for me.
Tilly Olson, whose own output was, a very wonderful stories and a short novel, but was always considered meager, at a certain point wrote in a book, I think, called Silences,
right,
that there were certain writers who were, in some sense, punished by their lives, which kept them away from their writing desks and always at the beck and call of the immediate and present moment. And she suggested that the life of many women writers in America were of the sort. You, on the other hand, have kept full tilt at a writing career while meeting what sounds like a fatiguing and constant set of demands as a lawyer. How do you feel about her justification of her of the difficulty she faced getting writing done?
And Tilly is a close friend to me, and I really would not like to get into commentary on her life. Her point that many women writers, and also men that she talks about, particularly in centuries before the 20th century, have been kept from writing by, poverty and other needs, particularly in the case of women, childbearing and rearing, is obviously true. There's no way to doubt that, and although both, she and I recognize that other writers, and including, I suppose me, managed to go on in circumstances that aren't perfect. She used to quote, I think it's Blake, but she said it was Blake. if there's fruit despite the blight, that you don't give credit to the blight. And, I have nothing to complain about. I made my choices. They were the right choices for me. I was driving myself crazy, literally, when I was doing nothing but writing. Getting involved with the law proved to be the way I could both not only pick up another field of knowledge that I've been able to play against in a literary sense, but it took away from me that awful self-consciousness that the years of trying to make myself a writer had imparted, and allowed me to find a voice. And so I made my choices, and they were good for me. That doesn't mean that it's good for every other writer to have to struggle to find the time to write, because, you know, the fact of the matter is that I'm, you know, unnaturally stubborn. And the one thing that I've noticed about my friends who have made it in the arts, whether it's, you know, filmmaking or as poets or as composers or as writers, is that they have stuck with it. And the harder it is to stick with it, the less likely it is that you'll succeed. So I really don't differ with Tilly's observations. I'm not, you know, I don't perhaps share with her the same willingness to cast blame. And I also think that there's something about, you know, child rearing in particular that may draw more on the same kinds of forces that otherwise would be put into writing, that may make it even harder for women who are doing that to, you know, to continue to prosper in the creative arts.
You credit one of your children with having produced the good lines in a particular chapter. Tell about that.
Well, this is completely true. My son Gabriel is a, you know, like many five-year-old children, which is what he was at this time, what was apt to say, as Art Linkletter used to put it, the darndest things. And we were driving down the street one day, and in the, you know, suburban town we live in outside Chicago, and he looks at me, says, "Does good always win?" I said, What? What'd you say?" He says, "Does good always win?" I said, "Well, where do you get that from?" He says, "Well, it does on television," and as in The Burden of Proof, where Stern, the hero, ends up having this conversation with a boy of similar age. You know, Gabriel had no knowledge of any kind that he had engaged in any form of abstraction. It was just clear from him, from watching He-Man, that good always won, and he wasn't sure about that. And so then he, you know, now he wants an answer from me. There were various conversations that I had with him during this extraordinary, unusual period in his life, that all of which got chucked into chapter 29 of The Burden of Proof. It's sort of typical of the way, you know, writers are apt to feast on anything you throw in front of them. And it's another good example, by the way, of how improvisational the writing of The Burden of Proof was. I heard it, and I said, somehow this is going to have to happen in this novel.
As I was reading The Burden of Proof, in which, how would one put it, many characters who at first seemed defined by their rectitude are gradually shown to have had other modulating influences,
right,
in their lives. I thought I'd ask you a perhaps impossible question. In a novel, in a certain sense, no one is innocent, because where would the space come to use an innocent character in a novel like this? I mean, he would be dramatically irrelevant, except perhaps as an example. But the result is a book where the sort of overwhelming feeling is that no one is innocent. And from time to time, it feels like, given the way this character, Sandy Stern, saves his opportunities for confrontation until he can have major whammos, it seems like that he would like to, you know, tie people down and tell them, you know, bound them and gag them and tell them how uninnocent he knows that they've been. Well, is anyone innocent?
Well, not in my view. there are a few lines near the end of the book where Stern finds himself in prayer, and I think, you know, my fundamental view of you know, the life of humanity and society is expressed there, that we are tethered by impulses of, you know, greed, egotism, vanity, lust, that we recognize, you know, our duty to struggle against those things. You know, we do, and, you know, often we succeed, but often we don't. And, you know, the question for me in writing this book was, I learned a lot by watching a very close friend of mine who died last year of cancer. He was older than I am. He was one of those great persons that you meet in the law. He was a judge before whom I appeared. He was an opponent in cases. He ultimately, at one point in my life, became my lawyer. John had this same recognition about people that Stern does, and he adored them. He adored them for all their failings. And, you know, that can be terribly saccharine. I hope, though, that in the burden of proof, in spite of all of Stern's harsh judgments of others and even of himself, that some of that, some of his pleasure in that and love for other people does manage to emerge. But it's obviously not harped upon. But it, you know, I hope that readers get to that point of recognizing that.
There's another related question, because again and again, when suspense is going to be the generating motor of a novel, you sometimes wonder, just as the absence of innocent characters is as much a function of their irrelevance to the nature of this kind of writing. I found myself wondering whether in this book, which has many characters who function at an odd distance from one another, they don't know each other's secrets, although they've lived with one another for 30 years. The father, Sandy, has what seemed to me to be an enormously pronounced distance and ignorance of his children and their motives and their interrelations. One would then say that in the world of this book, people are virtually unable to communicate their secret selves, and that they share, in many cases, a distrust, what's more, of psychoanalysis. And yet it struck me that, at the same time, that's a kind of mechanical function, too, of this kind of novel writing. If the dramaturgy is going to be one of revealed secrets, a family that is close-knit and well aware of one another's internalities are not going to function dramatically in this kind of book. Well, which is it? Is it a world in which people can't speak to one another and don't? Or simply a novel in which that is beneficial to the structuring of a suspenseful plot?
Well, I think the answer to your question, if your assumption is right, which it strikes me as an interesting one and probably a correct one, that one of the things that the mystery as a form reveals is the inability of people to really talk to one another about their inmost selves, including in this novel within families. Doesn't seem to me it would be a perpetual success unless people believed that that was, in fact, the truth. Stern, obviously, is a father in the mode of an earlier pre-feminist generation, and his distance from his children is, you know, certainly not one that's familiar to, you know, those of us who have reared our children in the 80s and the 90s. And perhaps it's unnatural even for an earlier era. But I do think that, especially between parents and children, you know, there can never be complete, there never can be complete knowledge of those inner lives. There's something in the roles of parent and child. For all the love there is there, and there is sometimes great love between Stern and his children, there's something that can't cross, you know, the modeling of roles that exists. Now, as between spouses, I mean, this is not what I would call in the end Stern's marriage with his wife, Clara, probably not a great marriage by anybody's definition. And I think people in whatever era could have done better. And of course, one of the things that happens as the burden of proof proceeds is that he comes to believe that, you know, not only could he have done better, but she could have done better as well.
I've been speaking to Scott Turow, the author most recently of The Burden of Proof, recently published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you for coming down and being so interesting with us today.
Thanks. Thank you for your interesting questions.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Bob Carlson. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ice and snow in books. As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold and books. Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Pop Time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.